Iran has its own humanitarian laws for trying such criminals and has every right to probe the past of any Swedish national apprehended by the Iranian security forces and to subject him or her to the punishment specified for such crimes. So, Stockholm should not shed crocodile tears if any of its officials whose crimes of their past are confirmed by the Iranian judiciary are subjected to prison terms. Whiplashes, amputation of fingers, and capital punishment if it is required.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We don't know about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Despite the UN brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi led war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health. Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Programme, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war. Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA.5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue the changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA.2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad. Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am, their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the 8th Shia Imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Verets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Riccelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism.
They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the others once terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful, but you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war, but the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO,
along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned US President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts say that all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden's support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Wednesday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation at the end of a bruising day in which his executive survived a confidence vote on a cost of living bill in the Senate, with one of the biggest parties in the government alliance, the Five Star Movement, abstaining from voting. In a statement, Draghi said that the pact of trust at the base of the government's action and the conditions to carry out the executive's program no longer exist. However, President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella rejected Draghi's resignation in an attempt to break the political impasse, inviting the former European Central Bank president to address Parliament and to assess the situation.
I have already said that there won't be a second Draghi government. Let me say, this executive has dealt with the ongoing tensions pretty well.
The Five Star Movement pooled its support for the government over a bill aimed at helping businesses and households with skyrocketing energy prices and a provision for a trash incinerator in Rome, a project the once anti-establishment party staunchly opposes. The Mario Draghi government was formed after ex-Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's second executive collapsed in February 2021. Draghi was appointed to address the consequences of the pandemic and to manage about 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans from the European Union for a radical restructuring of Italy's economy.
As usual, Draghi destroys the small and medium enterprises and destructure the economy rather than restructure it. The perspective is to transform the Italian economy in a weakened economy that will be a sort of ground for big multinational companies.
Italian President Mattarella takes on a central role now. It's up to him to decide whether to try to persuade outgoing Prime Minister Draghi to form another executive, find a new caretaker leader to take the country to an election next year, or call an early elections in September. October would be an unprecedented event in Italy's political history, as in the autumn, the government generally needs to prepare and pass its budget. Max Civili, Rome.
Festival seeks to honor media productions that best introduce Shia Muslims' eighth Imam Reza. Organized by the custodianship of the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, known as Astan Ghots Razavi, the media festival acknowledges documentary films, news reports, music clips, and motion graphics, among others, themed with the personality of Imam Reza. Imam Reza was born in 766 AD in the Saudi city of Medina. He's one of the descendants of Islam's prophet Muhammad. Imam Reza holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran's city of Mashhad, which was known back then as Tus. This love to the Imam draws millions of his lovers to his magnificently decorated shrine every year.
Imam Reza was a scientist, a religious leader, and a politician during the Abbasid dynasty in the 8th century BC, when the ruler of the time invited him to come to Iran to be the crown prince of the Muslim territory. During his tenure, Imam Reza left a lasting influence on Iranians through his appealing lifestyle. So it's up to us media activists to introduce his amazing character to the world.
Any media work that shines a brighter light on who Imam Reza was is precious in its kind. My work tried to explain the extent of love Iranians have for the eighth Imam, and I'm grateful that it was chosen as one of the best news reports on Imam Reza.
This is the second edition of the Imam Reza Media Festival. Astan Ghots Razavi says so far there's been a rise in the number of works submitted from foreign countries. It hopes that with stronger participation from international media activists, the personality of Imam Reza will be introduced to a wider audience across the world.
Organizers say this festival creates a competitive atmosphere among media activists, and this will help boost the quality of productions themed with Imam Reza. The ultimate goal, they say, is to better introduce the character of the Shia Imam and his instructions to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on December 17, 2008 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Qadir. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. First of all, I would like to congratulate you, dear people, all the faithful people of our country on Eid al-Qadir and the entire world of Islam. Eid al-Qadir is considered to be a major part of Shia's historical identity. Shia men and women have for consecutive years and centuries preserved their identity through the remembrance of this event. I would also like to welcome you, dear brothers and sisters, especially those who have come from faraway cities, and the esteemed families of our martyrs. Reflecting on Ghadir is one of the issues that can be of great help to our Islamic society, our people, and our country today. That is because reflecting on Ghadir will help them stay on the right path. There are two or three points that I would like to mention in regards to Ghadir. The event is one of the points that I would like to discuss. The world of Islam, which had grown relatively vast, was witness to a very important event towards the end of the Holy Prophet's life.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Commander of the Faithful was declared to be the successor of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. Ghadir is not simply an event narrated by Shi'as alone. Many Sunni luminaries and hadith scholars, muhaddithin, have also talked about this event. How the event should be interpreted is debated among Muslims. However, all Muslims are confident about the truth of this event. The fact that the Prophet assigned Imam Ali alayhi salam as his successor at the end of his life, about 70 days before his demise, bears testimony to the importance of government, politics, and religious leadership, wilaya, from an Islamic viewpoint. The emphasis that our magnanimous Imam Khomeini and many other prominent religious scholars have placed on the unity between religion and politics is in fact rooted in Islamic teachings, especially the great lesson that Ghadir taught us. This shows the importance of the issue. All the people who interpret Ghadir in this way, that is, all Shi'as, and even many non-Shi'a Muslims who have a similar interpretation, many constantly pay attention to the fact that the issue of government is a critical issue, and that it is a high priority in Islam.
Allah, I wanna thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
This one lay.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has wrapped up his tour of West Asia, but it was a trip that disappointed him since it was void of any major breakthroughs. For starters, Biden sought to use his first West Asia tour to reassert Washington's influence, but that fell flat. This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what those disappointments were. We will also look at why Iran has stated that Washington, quote, has once again resorted to the failed policy of Iranophobia, trying to create tensions and crises in the region. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. John Bustos joins us. He's a journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Also joining us is Firas Al-Najim, manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Bustos, first over to you. Some of the headlines, not all of them, but quite a few, said that the U.S. President Joe Biden wanted to use this tour of West Asia in order to reassert, whatever that means, Washington's influence. However, he emerged without a single diplomatic breakthrough. Do you agree with that? Isn't that a bit harsh?
Well, I think it's actually a little bit soft. The sad fact of the matter is that not only did the advance teams, the negotiating teams, fail to negotiate some projects that could be approved during his visit, but they also made the President of the United States look even weaker and less effective than he actually is. So they've done a double whammy against their own position, and they've lost face in the region. And that is a serious loss of public recognition and public support for the parties that were depending to get the American carte blanche as they've had in the past.
Firas Al-Najim, we want to break down some of the things that happened during this trip. And one of them, obviously, was the issue of Israel and Saudi Arabia getting closer in terms of so-called normalization to come out. Basically, we're looking at the Saudi Aviation Authority first when it made an announcement, if you recall, that it's lifted the overflight restrictions on all carriers going into from Israeli planes to use Saudi airspace. And many in Israel, such as Yair Lapid, claimed it was the first official step for normalization with Saudi Arabia. That was, however, rejected flat out by Prince Faisal, who said that the move had nothing to do with Israel and was not in any way a step towards normalization. Wasn't that, in a sense, a slap in the face of Israel and in turn the U.S.?
Yes, I mean, it's very clear from the trip it was engineered to only visit two countries and two different regimes pretty much in the Middle East, and that is, first he went to Palestine, occupied Palestine, to meet with the Israeli officials, then he went to Saudi Arabia to visit the Saudi officials there. And we see that at the same time that he did this visit, and then we see this announcing of, you know, opening the airlines and things like this, right? So this shows very clear that there is some agreements that are being binded, you know, under the table, and now they're slowly, slowly coming out in the public. And, you know, why did he go to only Palestine, and why did he only go to Saudi Arabia? Why did he not go to, for instance, Turkey? Why didn't he go to Egypt? He didn't go nowhere except these two countries. And this is Biden's first trip, you know, outside to the Middle East since he got presidency. So he disregarded, obviously, human rights and his promises of, you know, he said that he would hold the Saudi regime accountable for killing Khashoggi and the MBS, you know, MBS official. He said that MBS himself will be penalized for what, for this issue. And we see that he gave him a fist pump, and he said that, you know, that if anything like this happens again in the future, so that means pretty much this file is closed up and it's dealt with, and he let it go, that there's no accountability on this issue. So Khashoggi's murder and, you know, breaking international law, going inside of a consulate and doing all this was okay. They let it go because of interests and benefits. So really they stepped on human rights and they trampled over it in this trip. And at the same time, we've seen when he visited Palestine and he met with Israeli officials, right after he left, they started bombarding Gaza. So pretty much it was a green light given by Biden for the Israeli officials to start to bomb and hurt the Palestinian people.
Well, this is the part that's somewhat confusing, John Busnish, in terms of the oil factor, because obviously lots of write-ups before this trip that the reason, the main reasons Biden is going to West Asia is to see what it can do in order to boost oil production, in particular from Saudi Arabia, if not as a whole from the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf. I'm guessing the protocol is that you don't set up something unless you know the answer in that diplomatic world, that he should have known that that is not what's going to transpire, because you had Jake Sullivan who said that any action is going to be done within the context of OPEC Plus. You even had Biden who said concrete results will not be seen for another couple of weeks. So did he set himself up for failure going there for oil production boost?
Well, I think we've got a double failure on the part of Biden by announcing results, anticipated results, which he could not deliver. And on the support staff side, from the White House and from the State Department, who did not finalize any deals before the president got on the plane to the destinations. This is rudimentary first-grade diplomacy. I've worked in governments in Asia, in America, North America, and in Europe, and you never set a meeting without already having drafted the fundamental agreements that should be signed by your leaders at those meetings. The president doesn't do any negotiation. The president just comes, shows the flag, and signs the pre-negotiated deals. This really indicates that U.S. foreign policy is in disarray.
So you mean they didn't do that? So you mean they just went there and they figured they're just going to talk about it?
They obviously did not do that. And the fact that the United States could not agree major decisions with its two closest allies, with Israel and Saudi Arabia, implies that Biden and his State Department simply don't have any pull. And I think that the general worldwide view of Biden is that Biden himself is already a lame duck president, and nobody knows what to expect from the United States.
Okay, talk about areas that is unknown to the U.S. presidents that should be part of the protocol, as our guest there talked about, Firas al-Najim, is this Israeli Defense Pact. Now, there was a lot of write-ups on that there was going to be this integration of Israel with the regional countries to sign a defense pact or to hop on board a defense pact. But then you had, upon departure, when Biden was in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi foreign minister in a press conference said there was no discussion on a defense alliance with Israel in the GCC summit of the Persian Gulf countries. So was that another failure then, and another, lack of reaching a consensus before Biden's trip on that issue?
I mean, you know, you cannot believe everything they say, these officials, because they're good at manipulating, they're good at lying, they're good at fabricating. And the Saudi regime and their officials have all been raised and trained in U.S. facilities and U.S. universities and so on. And they've been working with the U.S. officials and, you know, they've been training them to be good liars. So you can't really trust them. I'm pretty sure they had some, agreements signed under the table, and they're working on certain agreements and so on to support Israel, to normalize with Israel. And even Netanyahu, not too long ago, was saying that I heard him say that he said that he's the relations with Saudi Arabia are getting very strong, and that he promised that if he was elected into power, that he would pact a agreement and the normalization would start between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So really, there's a lot of things happening under the table that we start to see slowly, slowly after some time. This trip was one of them, you know, right when they were in the trip while he was Biden visiting these places, we seen that there was something that propped up all of a sudden, that there's an agreement between airlines. This is something really big, you know, it's nothing small, because now they can transfer weapons to each other, they can visit each other. This is a very, very bad situation right now.
Uh-huh. Something that's not obviously discussed much, at least that particular yes. point that you talked about. All right, let's move on to something else here that the U.S. president said to John Busnich. And he said the U.S. is going to remain or will remain fully engaged in West Asia. Quoting him, we will not walk away and leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. Why does the U.S. think that there's going to be a vacuum in the first place? And if there is one, why does it think it needs to fill it? Because if it needs to fill it, then you would look at their achievements. But what are their achievements?
Right. I mean, you've hit the nail right on the head here. First of all, the vacuum that Biden is referring to is the kind of vacuum that was left in Afghanistan when the United States suddenly pulled out without even removing its own military equipment to the tune of billions of dollars. So the United States has demonstrated by its own actions within this past year that they are leaving not only massive power vacuums in places that they've previously occupied, but they've also left donations of billions of dollars of weapons to the people that they call their enemies. So we know that they're not competent. And by reinforcing the worry about a vacuum being created, Biden has actually just focused more attention on the United States failures. Secondly, when we talk about the United States being present and not allowing a vacuum to be filled by somebody else, what they're really talking about is militarily, because the United States generally talks softly and carries a big stick. And so the United States is going to attempt to show by a deployment of forces, by bringing the fleets in the region, that they're engaged and that they're threatening military action to reinforce their positions on a number of issues. That alone is going to be a massive expenditure of U.S. taxpayers' funds for a conflict which is 95% not likely to happen. So we've got a real mess at the top in the White House, and this is just another example of the problem.
Well, the Palestinian issue was something that really was a huge disappointment. I'm sure you'll agree for us on the team. And it's really, I'm not too sure what word to use. When you see what the president did, the outcome, where from what I'm understanding here, no progress at all when it came to obviously any type of peace negotiations. There was no condemnation of any kind behind all the different violations of Israel, of which he focused instead on economic measures, which included 4G internet for Palestinians. Do you think 4G internet for Palestinians is the number one issue of concern?
I mean, it's very clear, even when he was bringing up the name of the well-known Palestinian, American holding citizen, journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, he couldn't even spell her name right. You know, he couldn't even pronounce it right. You know what I mean? He said it very, very incorrectly, and he was stuttering, you know, because he knew this was a big crime and it's something that's important for the Palestinians. And many of the relatives of that journalist were sitting inside that room. And, you know, he was very weak. And you can see about her, he didn't cover. He wouldn't even want to visit Shireen Abu Akleh's family members and relatives. Later, he announced that they're welcome to come to the States, but they're thinking about it. They don't know if they want to go there because he disregarded them fully when he came to the land where she was killed. The West Bank, we've seen there's so much violations there, international laws being breached, evictions, and you know, thefts of homes and rebuilding of illegal settlements. He didn't speak anything about that. He just talked about, just briefly said, oh, we care about the dignity of the Palestinians and human rights and so on. He gave some pocket change to the Palestinian promise of $100 million or so on. Okay, and like you said, the 4G. I think the main concern is obviously human rights. I think the main concern is liberty, sovereignty, having a recognized, having embassies that are really recognized, where Palestinians are actually regarded as humans. Unfortunately, this man comes over there, does not even care about the Palestinians as if they're not even humans. And then when he goes to the side of the Israelis and the occupiers, he treats them like gold and he assures them so many things and gives them such big agreements as if they need more agreements and they need more help and more assistance. Where they're the ones that are occupying and they're the ones that are violating and they're the ones that are killing and they're the ones that are doing all kinds of crimes. And he showed clearly that he does not care about the Palestinians. And unfortunately, Mahmoud Abbas didn't hold him accountable and didn't, you know, make a very strong stand against him. He should have actually refused to see him because there is no real, you know, there's no real meat. What has he presented? Before he meets him, he should have presented to him a real plan on how the Palestinians are going to get some kind of statement.
Sure. Well, follow me on this train of thought and see if you agree with me, John Bosnich. I'm looking how the U.S. has obviously is all out against Russia on all fronts when you take a look at the way that it's acting against Russia. And it in turn then has its eye out for China. We know that for a fact. Now, if China is Saudi Arabia's number one customer, I know Russia has overtaken it recently, but in essence, Saudi Arabia sells the most oil to China. And taking a look at what Antony Blinken said last week at the G20, warning China not to support Russia and buy oil from Russia, doesn't Saudi Arabia then conclude, wait a minute, I'm going to be that China where the U.S. is going to say, hey, don't sell your oil to China down the road? That's what the U.S. is going to do because that's what it's doing right now when it comes to Russia and China. So why should Saudi Arabia even embrace the U.S. in any shape or form?
Well, the way you posed your question makes it sound like Saudi Arabia has a choice. And in fact, the power structures in the Middle East basically do not leave a choice to Saudi Arabia except to do what the United States says, because without the United States military support, Saudi Arabia is a non-viable, non-defendable state. And this is the situation that the United States president came thinking could dictate anything he wanted, and even that, he was unable to dictate properly what he wanted. I think we're seeing a real exposure of how weak and how disorganized the United States is under the current administration, and it's made even worse by a president who's accused of being senile, not only by his opponents, but by his allies.
Qatar made a strong statement for Al Thani. The prime addressing the summit was the Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. He went all out against Israel, blaming Israel for regional instability. He slammed the regime for illegal settlements. Let's see, what else did he do? And, of course, the blockade on the Gaza Strip. Now, it's interesting that he would do that, given the fact that there's a U.S. military base in Qatar. What do you think about the statements made there by the Emir?
I mean, I think they're good statements, and that's a different tone than the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Emiratis and all these other GCC countries or the ones that are silent, such as Oman. You know, it's something that we can build on. Hopefully that really they can get some sovereignty. As you said, they have a big U.S. base there, so it's kind of surprising how he can speak in this kind of manner. But like I said, like, you know, whoever speaks against the Israeli occupation, against the violations, against the crimes that are happening, the major blockade on the people of Gaza, especially after they bombarded them right after Biden visited them, that shows a very clear sign that Biden gave them a green light to bomb Gaza. So, I mean, that's a good sign. It's another regional country that hopefully, Iran and the axis of resistance can ally with and work with on certain fronts, especially for the Palestinian cause. And we hope more countries can awaken their governments and the governments can awaken and be able to really stand up for the Palestinian people and for the dignity of Palestinians, because, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. You know, and they're part of the region, and the Palestinians deserve human rights. They've been trampled on for many, many years now, 74 years. And it's continuous, and it's growing, actually. The situation is getting worse and worse. And whenever we see a new Israeli official, you see more crimes, more aggressions, more manipulation, more lies, and a harder life for the Palestinians. We can see very clear, even the Palestinians, how did they welcome the Israelis? They put signs up saying that this is apartheid, and that we want justice for Shireen Abu Akleh. So sure. It shows very clear that the Palestinians were rejecting the trip and weren't happy with Biden coming in.
I saved the best for last, and it has to deal with Iran there, John Bosnich. Obviously, we saw how Biden was embraced by Israel. We saw the doubling down of military support practically, not only for the Iron Dome, but this new laser machine of some kind, as if the Iron Dome was working so well that they now moved on to another equipment. Maybe that is supposed to make up the deficiency of the Iron Dome. Anyways, interestingly, Lapid said, got to use force against Iran. Diplomacy is not going to work. Talks are inadequate, of which after all the talk that Israel gave, at the end Biden said, well, we're still going to go for the diplomatic route, even though he did say if that doesn't work, then force will be used as a last resort. That has been taken as a disappointment by Israel and its officials, because they say that that's not what they had hoped for. How do you see the outcome of that?
Well, there are two sides to that coin. We're going for the diplomatic approval, fig leaf, to of the American policy. They will take a violent response. And every action that is coordinated between Israel and America should be taken in light of a very important fact. There was a book produced by Dr. John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago called The Israel Lobby. And in that book, he pointed out that 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party and 40% of the donations to the Republican Party come from the Israel lobby. So it wasn't Biden going to give orders to Israel. It was Biden going to Israel to take orders. That's what happened.
So is he going to get the 60%?
They always get their money. And in return for the money for their electoral campaigns, they have to do what the Israel lobby tells them to do. People should read that book, The Israel Lobby, Dr. John Mearsheimer. It is an eye-opener about international politics involving Israel and the United States.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. That's John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. First of all, Najim, thank you so much.